It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next Tuesday is the special primary election for the 7th Congressional District, a seat that used to be held by former Representative Sean Duffy. Today we kick off our series of interviews with the candidates with a conversation with Democrat Lawrence Dale. First, if you grew up in the era of the family landline, you probably remember what it was like to share the phone with the whole household. Siblings eavesdropping, other family members picking up the phone and dialing while you were in the middle of a conversation. Here's one memorable example from a scene with a phone call in the classic It's a Wonderful Life.
Hi, Sam.
Well, George Bailiofsky. Hey, a fine pal you are. What are you trying to do, steal my girl?
Oh, well, what do you mean? Nobody's trying to steal anybody's girl. Here's Marion.
Wait a minute. I want to talk to Rosa. Tell Marie to get on the extension.
You talk.
Mother's on the extension.
I am not.
We're moving away from the family landline in the era of cell phones, and our next guest says there are things that we're at risk of losing along with it. Julia Cho is a freelance writer whose work has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Atlantic. She's the author of the recent Atlantic piece, How the Loss of the Landline is Changing Family Life. Julia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Rob.
A lot of us have been through this experience, having a landline and now not having one. What led you to tackle this in this piece?
Well, the piece really came about just simply because one day I received a kind of rare phone call for my 11-year-old daughter on my cell phone, and I had to call her and tell her who it was. And I just realized that that had not really ever happened before, and it probably wouldn't happen. And I just started to think about what a really entirely different experience she was having growing up without that landline shared in the home.
Yeah, talk about those shared moments that we used to have on that family landline.
Sure. Well, in general, we didn't have the privacy, so I had a lot of memories of, you know, growing up and being attached to the corded phone, talking late at night with my best friend sitting on the kitchen floor. And I had a lot of memories of, as well, of just picking up the phone and whether I was speaking to my mother's boss or my brother's friends, having to interact with different family members. And having to listen a lot as well, getting the chance to listen a lot to my mother's conversations, whether they were with my grandmother about, you know, family things or if she was speaking to a business, and just participating more in each other's lives, whether it was waiting for somebody to get off the phone. It wasn't always great. It wasn't always perfect, but we definitely had more of a sense of what was going on in each other's lives a little bit more.
And the trend, I mean, it seems anecdotally like we're moving away from the landline. It sounds like statistics back that up. Is that right?
Yes, that is true, that most people, more people have only the cell phone at this point in their homes in America.
And there's that that mystery when you called someone that we don't have anymore.
Right.
Is my friend going to answer or whoever I'm trying to call?
Right.
Is it going to be mom or dad? Or a memorable moment when I was in high school, my voice started to sound like my dad's voice. It could be an adventure when my girlfriend tried to call me.
Right.
They didn't know which one they were talking to right off the bat.
Yeah.
Did you have...
Did you have
stories like that? Or do you have moments like that as a thinking back as a kid?
Well... Do I have moments? Not really. Anything comes to mind in particular.
Now, what do we lose if we don't have that as a family, first of all?
Well, I think it's just one shared family experience that we had, and definitely not the only one. So when I talked to some psychologists, some other suggestions were to just make sure that we kind of make up for that we have different shared experiences that we're still having, like, you know, family dinners and playing with our kids when they're younger, watching a movie together, basic shared family experiences. That certainly wasn't the only one, but just so that we can stay connected and, you know, having tech-free spaces in the home so that we're not always in our private virtual spaces, but we're also in the actual physical space of the home.
And there's also together. The idea of, you know, not getting kids their own phones until later and having mm-hmm. some kind of shared experience. And you talked to some experts and others. What kind of things are people doing?
Well, like I mentioned, having that kind of sacred tech-free space in your home. Also, even though we don't have the phone that's on the wall anymore, we can still put our phones in one shared space where they're all going to charge together. And one psychologist I talked to even recommended putting them all in the master bedroom closet so that the kids can't just go get them. I mean, that might be a little bit extreme, but so having, creating kind of that space where they're going to be anchored in the home. And then there are, you can take a screen-free day, which is something that I try to do in my home. So maybe on one day of the weekend, we'll just say we're not going to be on our screens, we're not going to be on our devices today. And there are organizations, I'm actually part of one that I signed a pledge, it's called Wait Until ACE, where your child, you agree basically that you won't get your child a smartphone until they're in eighth grade at least.
Talking to Julia Cho. Talking to Julia Cho about her recent piece, How the Loss of the Landline is Changing Family Life. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you grow up with a landline family phone? Do you still have one? If not, do you miss it? Do you miss that experience? What were some of the positives and negatives? Would you go back to it if you had the option now? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 on the landline or cell phone or whatever kind of phone you use. Julia, one of the experts you talked to talked about this as just one symptom of a decline of the importance of our home lives, of being at home. What kind of things did they have to say?
I think, well, one of the people, his name is Luke Fernandez, said that, you know, the phone was more of an anchor for the home. And I think we were more reachable as a family unit. If you even think about answering machines, they announced a residence as opposed to an individual. We had the phone in our home, and now it's my phone. So everything's just become more individualized and privatized. And he kind of mentioned, you know, we have gained privacy and mobility, but it's the value of the home that's been a little bit diminished.
We heard from Glenda on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Glenda writes, we lost being able to call our kids and have the grandkids answer the phone. That's kind of a fun moment that we kind of lose without that family landline, isn't it, Julia?
Yeah, it definitely is. Yeah, there's definitely... there's definitely that ability to bypass certain people and just go directly to who you want to talk to.
Well, and it's kind of a quandary because sometimes I would want to call and talk to, you know, like either of my parents, but they, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes I know they each have their own cell phone and I don't want to have to pick or choose. It seems like we need to develop a new etiquette of how we call people as a family sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely think we have to be a little bit more thoughtful about, how we want to approach it. That's true. That's a good point. And I hadn't really delved into that, but I've noticed even as my daughter has gotten an iPod, it's not a phone, but that my own mother, her grandmother, is sort of bypassing me to talk to her, which is sort of interesting. So there's a lot of room for that to happen. And I think we just have to be kind of cognizant of it and a little more intentional.
Well, we have landline phones here at Wisconsin Public Radio, and our lines are full. Let's bring out a caller. Kate is with us in Milwaukee. Kate, hello.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Kate?
Well, there was a power outage about a year or so ago, and I have a landline with two wireless phones, but I forgot I also have a wall phone connected, and that was the only one that worked. So for emergency purposes, I really like having that phone, and I forgot all about it because I hadn't used it in so long.
So you made a decision, Kate, to keep it around even though you hadn't used it in forever till that power outage?
Oh, yeah, right. It's much more dependable than anything else.
Kate, thank you so much for sharing that. Julia, do you hear that from people, that that corded phone was, whether you liked it or not, more dependable than some of the other options?
Yes. Yeah, I definitely heard that from a lot of people, that that's usually the reason why they're keeping their landline. And it was kind of interesting because I feel like a few years ago or even a decade ago, people were really proud that they didn't have the landline, that they had cut the cord and gotten rid of it. And now I actually heard from a lot of people, they sounded kind of proud that they still had their landline and they like to keep it for the emergencies.
Kate, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Michelle now, also in Milwaukee. Michelle, hello.
Hi. I guess for me, it's like a kind of an interesting experience because I'm in that in-between generation. I'm 38, so I definitely remember having a landline growing up. And then we definitely quickly moved into cell phone culture. One of the biggest shifts that I noticed, though, was my grandparents lived into their 90s. And as cell phone, we haven't had a landline in probably 10, 15 years. And as cell phone culture kind of took over, they would never know who to call to reach who they were looking for. So sometimes if they were looking for my dad, they'd call my mom or they'd call myself or my sister or brother. And we could literally all be in different states or different parts of the world. But, you know, because we didn't have that central location for them to call, it was just different, you know, very different. Even though they had cell phones as well, and they didn't use them though. But it's just culturally so different now.
Interesting, Michelle. Thanks. Thanks a lot for calling in, Julia. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of what you were mentioning before. It definitely changes who we can interact with, and it's one of those more subtle losses that I think I was thinking about when I wrote the piece that are kind of being missed, I think. Like, we're not necessarily noticing them because the technology is moving so quickly now.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Julia Cho about her recent piece in The Atlantic, looking at the decline of the family landline and the role it played in family life. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you still have a landline in your home? If so, why have you decided to keep it? If not, what made you get rid of yours? And positive or negative, what do you notice about differences in how you communicate with people, how things work around your household in the post-landline era? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about the decline of the family landline and what it's changed in our lives. Julia Cho is with us. She wrote a piece in The Atlantic. It's called How the Loss of the Landline is Changing Family Life. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Before we go back to our callers, Julia, Don posted on our Facebook page, we lost having our dinner interrupted by telemarketers and political parties disguising as poll calls to promote their candidate. And I know I've heard other people, Julia, who didn't grow up with landlines say things like, wait a minute, other people could make a thing in your house ring whenever they wanted to and you were obliged to answer it. Some people look at it as something that was maybe kind of intrusive. Do you see anybody with that frame of mind?
Well, I have heard that a lot. some, especially in the younger millennials that I talk to, they just saw it as being telemarketers. And even people that keep it now for emergencies said that it's kind of a pain because the only people that call it are telemarketers. But I think there was a time, at least when I was growing up, when there weren't as many of those. So it was mostly people that you knew calling. But that definitely is, there are definitely pros and cons to both of them. And that would definitely be one of the cons.
Let's go back to our callers. Peter is with us in Wales. Peter, hello.
Good afternoon.
What do you want to tell us about, Peter?
I'm old enough to remember going to my grandparents' farm in central Wisconsin, and their phones were set up in groups of four or five farms, and you had to go through the operator. And when you would dial zero, it was a big old phone on the wall where you had the receiver up right on the phone, and then you would listen to this like cone shaped thing, and you would have to tell the operator, okay, I want long short, or I want 1, 2, 3, because those four or five farms had a number, or their so-called phone number was a series of three sounds or three numbers. And then she would ring that household. If you had to go outside of that group of farms, then you would literally have to know the name of that household, and she would try to get you through. But my point is, she knew everything that was going on within that little town.
Peter, thanks a lot for that call. Yeah, things had changed before the decline of the landline, Julia. We used to have to share our conversations not just with the family, but with, as in this case, four or five neighbor families, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that definitely is part of it. From really the beginning, the invention was really a communal invention because of the necessity for the operators, and the early rendition of it, of course, was the party line where people were sharing which most people don't seem to miss that aspect of their neighbors being able to listen in on their conversation.
Thanks for the call, Peter. But you just used that word communal, Julia, and it seems like we've evolved into from that most communal to least possible communal with our individual cell phones. Does that, I don't know, worry you? Does that make you worry about that change?
I don't know if worry is the right word, but I think what I really was trying to do, and more than just being nostalgic or villainizing the technology, I was thinking about something that psychologist and tech expert Sherry Turkle had said about how when we look at things that we miss, we can kind of see what we value and what we care about so that we can just be more intentional about shaping the technology as we go forward. So I think it's just something to really notice that, wow, we're not hearing each other or talking to each other as much. And when we're texting, it's very silent. Like, that's something else that's really changed, is that the home used to have the ringing phone and conversation, and now you can be having a lot of conversations and people who are near you don't hear any of that. They're looking at you and you're just tapping away. So that's really changed.
Talking to Julia Cho, she wrote the piece, How the Loss of the Landline is Changing Family Life, that appeared recently in The Atlantic. Back to your calls now. We've got Jim in Portage. Jim, hello.
Hello. Some things that I remember is when I'm being in high school and maybe freshman and afraid of a girl calling, or not afraid of a girl calling, but she would call and afraid of my sister picking up. There's no caller ID. And then also being a prankster is doing all the prank calls. I mean, that was innocent fun. But with caller ID, you can't do that anymore.
Jim, thanks for the call. I don't think I'm going to mourn the loss of the prank call, Julia. But that skill of, as you were saying earlier, you might have to socially interact with anybody, including, you know, your boyfriend's sister or something like that. Is that a skill that we can make up for in maybe different ways as we raise our kids who aren't answering those calls from whoever?
Right. That's a good question. I mean, I think as parents, we can try to give our kids other opportunities to either make phone calls or have conversations or go into a store and buy something, you know, just other times where they're going to have to converse with different adults or authority figures. But I mean, that particular means of talking to different people, I don't really see coming back.
Thanks for that call. Anne joins us now in Sun Prairie. Anne, hi.
Hi. I gave up my landline 4 years ago, and I desperately miss it. The reason I miss it the most is because of the clarity of the calls, the dependability of the service, the fact that you can be on a lengthy call with someone and not get dropped at the pivotal moment, and you could call the dreaded customer service and stay on hold for a long time and then get dropped right when your representative comes on the line. And I think it was mentioned a bit ago that the reliability of a hardwired copper phone cannot be beat. I was reminded of one of the hurricanes that devastated Florida in the recent years, and there was no phone service to be had. And I saw on the news a person in Key West who had no home left. He had nothing. All he had was a hardwired original copper phone line, and he was able to call to the outside.
Wow.
And I think we need to measure what we've lost. I know, you know, being a talk radio service, you are probably all too well aware of the vagaries of callers, particularly statewide. If you're on a network that doesn't play well with the person answering in Madison, et cetera. So I guess It's just another aspect to look at what we've really lost.
And thanks for the call. This isn't something you focus so much on your piece, Julia, but there's a social thing. Like, when you pick up that landline phone, you were pretty sure it was going to work and you're going to have a connection. Now we, you know, it's getting better over time, but there is a certain element of chance, it seems like, with the cell phones.
Yeah, there definitely is. I mean, it's interesting because We started out saying when the phone was invented, are you there? And now we're saying, you know, where are you? Like, people are no longer located in a specific space that we can kind of count on. And actually, even though the piece wasn't really focused on that, I did start to delve in a little bit. And maybe it's a topic for another piece, but a lot of those copper wires are actually being replaced to be digital. And so even though people think they might have the security of the landline, it seems like they might not anymore. But that's it. It's kind of another topic, but something to think about.
And thanks a lot for the call. Julia, to the idea of, okay, what were we nostalgic about with the landline and how we can bring it back? I think of, you know, my kids were too old for this, but now my brother has little kids and they can use FaceTime with my parents and all of them, you know, the whole family on each end can get together and all talk at once. Do you see us using even newer technology to maybe find some of what we lost with the landline?
Yeah, I do. I do recommend using FaceTime over just texting or even calling. And that's something that another psychologist I talked to recommended, because if you are, that's one of the ways that this can actually unite us and help us. If you are located, you know, across the country from your grown child in college or more grown, they can show you their new apartment, you know, on their FaceTime. And I encourage my daughter to do it on her iPod. She can FaceTime friends because it's good. It's even the best kind of practice. They can see gestures and make eye contact, that kind of goes along with conversation.
As we wrap up in our last minute, Julia, clearly you've put some thought into this and become, it sounds like, even more conscious about how you use our technology. And I've got to admit, I kind of just take the changes as they come. Can you leave us with a pep talk to think about the way we communicate and the way we use our technology?
Well, I think kind of what I said before about just looking at what we missed, taking the time to kind of notice that and just remember what it is that you valued about that when you're feeling that nostalgia, what is it that you're kind of showing that you care about, and then trying to be a little more intentional going forward so that we can keep those values.
Julia, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Julia Cho. She was with us today to talk about her recent piece for The Atlantic. It's titled How the Loss of the Landline is Changing Family Life. You can still share your memories, your thoughts on that change on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, Central Time is talking this week to the candidates running in a special primary election for the 7th Congressional District ahead of the vote next Tuesday. We'll start things off with one of the two Democrats in that race. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. After President Trump ousted two of the witnesses who offered impeachment testimony, the Senate's top Democrat is calling for an investigation into witness retaliation by the president. We'll look at the latest fallout coming up. First, voters in Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District get their first chance to pick a new representative in Congress in next Tuesday's special primary election. The district was previously held by former U.S. Representative Sean Duffy. It spans 20 counties in northern and central Wisconsin. All this week, we'll talk to the candidates on the ballots, and today we'll start with one of two Democrats on the ticket. Lawrence Dale is an independent insurance agent and a candidate for Congress in Wisconsin's 7th District Democratic primary. Lawrence, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, start us off, Lawrence, please, with your basic pitch for voters. Why should they vote for you?
Well, that's one thing about my campaign. I don't really have a basic pitch, but I do have a legislative agenda that I envision upon being elected to Congress. And I think the most immediate thing that I see, especially with regard to the 7th District, is that we have to retain all the small businesses that we have. We can't afford to be losing any. And, you know, since 2004, not specific to the 7th District alone, but we've lost about 7,000 small dairy farm operations. And as you know, these are highly capitalized. They could be in excess of several million dollars in land, plant, animals, equipment, and all that kind of thing. And yet we're seeing these vibrant businesses being basically foreclosed upon. We lead the nation here in Wisconsin for foreclosures on small farm operations for the last 3 years. So I would, first of all, in Congress, I would seek legislation that would put a moratorium on these industrial dairy farm operations. That way, you know, we're not really seeing fair competition between the small dairy farm operators and these concentrated animal feeding operations, in this case, the industrial dairies. And secondly, I think we need to look at a policy like Canada's that really focuses on preserving the small family farms, and it's called supply management. And just the opposite has been happening here in Wisconsin. We are seeing legislation in terms of initiatives being passed that increase the production of, that call for the increased production of raw milk at a time, and this was back in 2012 with the initiative that was called Grow Wisconsin Dairy. And that was done to increase production at a time when we were already seeing oversupply of raw milk, forcing thousands of small dairy farm operations to leave the business. Now, this kind of thing just smacks of corruption. I mean, why would an initiative be passed to increase milk production when small family farm operations are being forced out of business already by oversupply? So, you know, once you get an oversupply going, what it does, it reduces the cost for small farmers, and if the costs go below their operating costs, then they're forced to leave. The thing is, small dairy farm operators in Wisconsin produce a superior product. They're environmentally friendly and sustainable, and we don't see things like it's happening now where the governor is asking for taxpayers' money to clean up the manure mess left behind by these industrial dairies.
Lawrence, I want to switch gears to cover some other topics, too. We invited listeners to offer questions on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Marianne has a health care question. She wants to know if you'll protect people with pre-existing conditions. What would you tell her?
Well, I'm in favor of the Medicare for All, which means that it doesn't matter, you know, what kind of condition you're in or what kind of medical care or mental health care you need. Under the Medicare for All system, we would see everybody being treated as having a right to Medicare and a right to health care, rather. And so with that being the case, everybody would be covered. And I know a lot of people are thinking, well, yeah, that sounds like a lot of money, and it is. And the way we get that money is just like FDR did back in the 30s. He went to the business sector to get it. It's called a wealth tax, and we see large sectors of our economy that, especially in financial services and in Wall Street, that don't pay taxes on their trades. But if you walk down the street of Superior or any other town where you had a merchant selling goods, they would be also putting sales tax on that transaction. So there's plenty of money just on Wall Street alone to cover the cost of Medicare for All. And then you don't have to worry about deductibles and copays. We have a dysfunctional healthcare system right now, and we're seeing 500,000 Americans a year having to declare bankruptcy just because they get sick. And this is the same thing for small business operations, dairy farmers, and farmers, you know, all across the seventh face this prospect. Insurance is unaffordable under the current system, and it's time to move on. And there's plenty of money there through a wealth tax to come up with whatever the cost might be.
Talking to Lawrence Dale, running as a Democrat in the primary race in a special election for the 7th Congressional District. We also heard from Dave on Facebook, who wants to know if you support campaign finance reforms, and Dave says getting special interest money out of politics.
You know, I think that's the whole problem with the dairy crisis we're having in this state. We have a corrupt Republican leadership that is really turning their backs on the small business operations here in Wisconsin, not only in dairy, like I just explained, but also 5 years ago, they put through the mining bill, Senate Bill 1, and that was sponsored by Tom Tiffany. And there was no discussion about this mine bill with the community. It was just kind of shoved down our throats up here. And what that mining bill called for was the utter destruction of our multi-billion dollar tourist economy. They planned on strip mining an area. In fact, it was part of the bill, and Tom Tiffany spearheaded this bill. And you should keep that in mind. But what's happening is we're seeing these politicians, and there's Democrats that do it too, that seem more interested in their self-promotion and their own careers than they are interested in the public interest. And that's why we need public financing of elections. Now, my opponents, I just read, between the two Republicans have over $1,300,000 already into the primary. And you know what? I'm lucky to have gas money. So I hope people go to my website and do a donation. My website is dale2020.com to keep this campaign alive. None of the other candidates, Democrat or Republican, have any plans as far as helping the farmers. The other thing I would do legislatively to help the farmers is to make sure that this milk is labeled. You know, with the industrial dairy farms, they use a lot of antibiotics to keep, you know, 6,000 to 7,000 cows on one farm from being overcome by viruses. And of course, that lowers our susceptibility to viruses of all kinds. And once we partake that milk, there should be strong labeling requirements so that the consumer can know the difference. And, you know, I can't see why Governor Evers is trying to raise $1 million to bail out that industry. They're just a horrific public health hazard to have them in this state to begin with. And there's 16 of them in Kewaunee County that used to be a tourist area. And now we're seeing algae blooms on Lake Michigan. We're seeing all this manure they produce on a daily basis, which is like, I don't know, 16 times more than it's produced in Madison on a daily basis. So this is a real problem. That industry should take care of their clean up after themselves or get out. They're too much of a health hazard to have around to begin with. And the Republican leadership knew that from the get-go, and so did the Democrats who were in power even before them. So they're not acting in good faith with the people of Wisconsin or of the 7th District. And we have to have somebody near like me who's going to fight to make sure our small businesses are kept alive, and that these threats of throwing in these huge industrial multi-billion-dollar big ag and big mining, big oil, all coming at us, all this money being thrown into the Republican and some of it into the Democratic campaigns. I'm not a zealot for either party. I am an FDR Democrat, and I think that and I know that more attention has to be focused on ensuring that the rights of working people are upheld and not the big corporations.
Let me throw one more issue at you before we run out of time. Lawrence, immigration, a long-running issue in Congress and for President Trump, for that matter. What would your priorities be?
Well, first of all, it's a problem that's really created by big business. They're the ones that are hiring these people into the country that have job openings. I guess you heard about the big raids that were going on in Mississippi to get all these Mexican foreigners that had come into this country illegally, but nevertheless got jobs, you know. So if you're out there advertising for jobs, you know, on the underground communication market, then you're going to get this problem. So the fact is there should be more pressure put on the employers and higher fines and making sure these people, you know, are documented before you hire them. Secondly, we're seeing a lot of money in terms of subsidies thrown out there to the large corporate farms, the commodity crop growers of corn, soy, and wheat. And what we're seeing with them is that they're so highly subsidized that they can undercut Mexican markets for corn, for example, throwing millions of farmers and their families, millions of people out of work. And that puts pressure on our borders. They're desperate. And of course, the other thing is we're not monitoring the foreign aid we're giving to places like Honduras and El Salvador. Why do they have all this gang violence down there? Why do these countries not have democratic elections? Those are things that we could monitor and help with. And that would take the pressure off the border big time. All these suggestions that I just gave.
Lawrence, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me, and I hope everybody gets out and votes on February 18th. My website is dale2020.com.
That's Lawrence Dale, an independent insurance agent. He's a Democrat running in next Tuesday's special primary election in the 7th Congressional District. To hear more conversations with some of the other candidates in the race, tune in to Central Time tomorrow and Thursday at 3:30. It's not the only primary election on next Tuesday's ballot. Voters statewide will get their first chance to vote for candidates running for state Supreme Court this year. Tune into the morning show this week to hear interviews with each of those candidates. And to catch up on any candidate interview you may have missed, go to WPR.org and click on the politics link in the news tab. Coming up, President Trump reassigned one key impeachment witness and fired another, raising concerns about witness retaliation. We'll get the latest, including reaction from Congress, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new report finds that two-thirds of Wisconsin's rural counties saw a population decline between 2010 and 2018. We'll look at those numbers and the impact it could have on rural communities. First, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer is calling for an investigation into witness retaliation by President Trump. The move comes after Trump fired Gordon Sondland, the U.S. ambassador to the European Union, and reassigned Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman back to the Pentagon. The two were key witnesses during Trump's impeachment proceedings in the House. On CBS's Face the Nation yesterday, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina defended the decision to remove Vindman.
People in his chain of command have been suspicious of him regarding his political point of view.
The national security advisor to the president sat in the chair you're sitting in last week and said he was confident that there were no leaks from the National Security Council.
Well, I am not. I want the man to be asked about what he did with the information.
In a letter to 74 inspectors general, Senator Schumer wrote, quote, "These attacks are part of a dangerous growing pattern of retaliation against those who report wrongdoing, only to find themselves targeted by the president and subject to his wrath and vindictiveness." And while Graham also supported Sondland's firing, Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson said he urged Trump to not fire him, at least not right away. Daniel Lippman covers the White House in Washington for Politico. Dan, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us more about the circumstances of the reassignment of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman and the recall of Ambassador Sondland?
Yeah, so Vindman had been a key impeachment witness for the Democrats. He is the, or he was the Ukraine country director for the NSC, you know, serving in the military. And so he's being sent back to the Pentagon, where he will head to Army War College to be a professor. And the Army is not going to take part in the retribution against Vindman that Trump has spearheaded. Even his twin brother, Yevgeny Vindman, who also was an NSC lawyer, kind of coincidentally, he was sent back as well to the Army. He's going to work in the general counsel's office. But the brother didn't even testify in the impeachment probe. And so, you know, just because he's related to his brother, that means that he was a casualty of this.
That's the Vindmans. How about Ambassador Sondland?
So Sondland was a political appointee. You know, all ambassadors are appointees, either politically or their career ambassadors, members of the Foreign Service. And so he is back in Brussels this week, but is packing his stuff and is heading back home after. He donated $1 million to the Trump Inauguration Committee, wanted that ambassadorial slot. And he testified to the House that everyone was in the loop. Everyone knew what was going on, that this was, in fact, a quid pro quo. And, you know, Trump was trying to get him, get Sondland to go to the Ukrainian government to get that announcement of investigations. Trump was unhappy that Sondland was a witness. He thought that he should have shut up. And so he was recalled. All political appointees serve at the pleasure of the president, but a lot of senators, both Democratic and Republican ones, they're unhappy that there have been this retribution against Sondland and other impeachment witnesses.
You wrote about efforts by Republican senators to talk to President Trump and talk him out of releasing Sondland right away, including Wisconsin's own Ron Johnson. Can you talk about what they were hoping to see?
Yeah, so I talked to Johnson yesterday, and he detailed kind of his efforts to get Sondland to be protected from Trump's wrath. He was ultimately not successful, but basically his pitch was that Sondland was planning on leaving anyway in a few weeks, and that he should be left to exit on his own terms. But Trump did not see it that way, and that he thought that Sondland should go immediately. And Sondland was actually asked by the State Department to resign, and he refused, so he was ordered to be fired. And so this is pretty, you know, amazing stuff when you think about what the message it sends to future whistleblowers and people who are thinking of exposing wrongdoing in the government, that their careers and their jobs could be in jeopardy if they speak up. I do think that Sondland is very well rich, and so he'll be fine. And the Vindman brothers, their careers won't be hurt in the end too much. But it does give people second thoughts when they see, you know, people like Vindman get escorted off the White House campus by security officers, kind of frog marched out of the White House. You know, it can only hurt morale among people who are civil servants and are just trying to do a good job.
Daniel Lipman is with us from Politico, talking about the dismissal or reassignment of two key impeachment witnesses. One person who had second thoughts and probably first thoughts, too, was Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, a Democrat, making a request to inspectors general. What is he looking for?
So he is, you know, pretty much asking the inspector generals to look into it. And also, you know, they want to prevent this from happening to other people. There are a number of other officials who had testified, Laura Cooper at the Defense Department, David, I forget David's last name, but there's George Kent at the
David
State
Holmes,
Department.
I think.
Yeah, David Holmes, you know, the clean cut blonde guy from Ukraine, the political officer there. And so Schumer and other senators don't want this to become too much of a trend. And so they are asking for kind of a halt in retributions, and also inspector generals to look into whether this violating laws and, you know, kind of the examine the details of Trump's vindictive behavior.
Now, Kellyanne Conway, a key player in the White House, was on Fox and Friends this morning, asked whether more people might be forced out of their roles. She said, quote, maybe. Do we know of anyone else who is believed to be maybe on the hot seat here?
So the Washington Post reported that Michael Atkinson, who is the inspector general for the intelligence community, who was, you know, kind of gave the whistleblower complaint to Congress several months ago, Trump is thinking of firing him. According to reports, I talked to, you know, a source in the government today, and they said, you know, that's what they're hearing as well. But it doesn't look like Trump has decided on that. And there are other people who could lose their jobs. But and we're also looking at the National Security Council is likely to shrink more. People are going to lose, you know, go back to their agencies. This was announced already, but in a kind of interesting timing that this is happening this week as well.
What are you watching for next on this story?
I think I'm just watching for whether, you know, kind of the makeup of the National Security Council after this, whether it's as effective as before. You know, Trump does not like people telling him things that he doesn't want to hear, and he often ignores advice and intelligence and policy recommendations from career government staffers. He doesn't trust that stuff, and so I'm watching for more hints of that type of you know, behavior from Trump.
And do you expect to see any more criticism or pushback from Republican senators, a few of whom at least objected to the way Ambassador Sondland was dismissed?
I think if we see more examples of this, then we will we'll see more criticism. This is, you know, Ron Johnson also criticized Trump and other Trump allies from, you know, who criticized Mitt Romney's religion. You know, that was a theme that the Trump people were hitting last week. And that's not something that gives lots of joy to Republican senators, because they were trying to have him change his behavior. But he's kind of, it's hard to, you know, take off your stripes if you're a tiger or whatever.
Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel Lipman covers the White House in Washington for Politico. We talked to him about President Trump's decision to remove from their posts two key witnesses during the House impeachment proceedings. He recalled U.S. Ambassador to the European Union Gordon Sondland and reassigned Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman to the Pentagon. White House Counselor Kellyanne Conway says more dismissals are possible. You can keep following these stories on the WPR.org page. We've got coverage from NPR there and on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Valentine's Day is this week. Many people will buy candy for their Valentine or for themselves. Both are good. No judgment. But what is the most popular Valentine candy? A non-scientific industry survey has some answers. Central Time producer Bill Martins is fluent in the language of love and candy. Hey, Bill.
This is when I come alive, man. This is when I shine.
That's right. Now, we have this map of the United States. What do we want in Wisconsin on Valentine's Day?
Okay, so apparently the number one Valentine's Day candy in Wisconsin is...
Okay, drum roll. That's a drum roll.
Conversation hearts.
Right, those little hearts that say, be mine, or my Valentine, or no chance, or whatever.
Right, exactly.
There's pros and cons.
It wouldn't have been my number one, but apparently it's what we in Wisconsin love.
Yeah, they're like minty chalk. Who doesn't love that?
Exactly. Number two was Hershey Kisses.
Okay, that's
staple,
chocolate in
pretty
a funny
standard.
Yeah, shape. Can't
yeah,
go wrong
fine.
There.
I like the dark chocolate ones better than the regular, but, you know, they make them in different kinds. And then number three, and this one's kind of tricky, the Ghirardelli gift box.
Right. The San Francisco chocolate brand.
But that's not the same thing as the heart-shaped box of chocolates.
Right, which was big in a lot of other states.
But the other thing that's weird is that Ghirardelli makes heart-shaped box of chocolates. So I don't know what they're doing in there. But.
We don't want heart-shaped things in Wisconsin.
Apparently.
Except for conversation
except for
hearts.
The cards, yeah.
Okay, that threw off my whole theory.
Can we get some Central Time conversation hearts?
Yeah.
Would that be weird?
Please call. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.